All right, welcome everyone to another deep dive. Today we're going to be taking a closer look at a legal case from 1967, Sackett v. Spindler. Now, you might be thinking 1967, that's got to be some dusty old case. Why are we even bothering with this? But stick with us, because the issues at the heart of this case, they're still really important for contract law even today. Like, what happens when a contract goes seriously wrong? How do you figure out the right amount of compensation when something unique is involved? The whole idea of, you know, keeping your losses in check. These are all super important ideas that are still relevant.
Yeah. And for, you know, especially for all of you law students out there who are, you know, grappling with these concepts in your classes, seeing how these ideas actually played out in Sackett v. Spindler is, I think, going to be really valuable for you.
Absolutely. So to guide us through this deep dive, we've got, you know, a bunch of materials that that we can work with. We've got a little guidance on how to approach this case for this deep dive. And we have a standard case brief, you know, kind of laying out the essentials, and then a more detailed brief as well. And even a perplexity analysis, which I'm really curious to hear more about what that even means.
Yeah, that's kind of a fun one. It's looking at how the court sort of structured its reasoning and how complex that reasoning was and what that might tell us about, you know, the case itself. But before we get too deep into the weeds of the legal analysis, how about we start with the basics? What actually happened in Sackett v. Spindler? What's the story here?
Okay, so let's rewind all the way back to 1961. We've got Sheldon Sackett and Paul Spindler, and they strike a deal. Sackett agrees to buy all the shares of S&S Newspapers from Spindler for a cool $85,000.
Yeah.
And they even set up like a, you know, payment plan, right, with three specific deadlines for these payments.
Okay, so pretty big deal with a, you know, clear payment schedule. So where did things go wrong?
Well, the first payment of $6,000, that went through no problem. But then with the second payment, things started to get a little messy. This one was for $20,000.
Yeah.
Sackett was late on that one. And he was also short like $200. Not the best start.
Yeah, not a great sign.
And then the real trouble came with the final payment, the big one, for $59,000. The check that Sackett gave for that bounced, you know, insufficient funds.
Oh, wow. That's a major issue in any kind of financial agreement. So how did Spindler react to that?
Yeah, you can imagine he wasn't too thrilled about it. So because the stock certificates were being held in escrow, you know, basically like a neutral third party holding onto them till the deal was done, Spindler took steps to get them back. Now, to be fair to Spindler, he didn't just, you know, immediately give up on the whole thing. He actually gave Sackett multiple extensions.
Yeah.
You know, based on Sackett's assurances that he was going to come up with the money. You know, the classic, the checks in the mail kind of story.
Right. So it sounds like Spindler was trying to be, you know, somewhat reasonable and patient, at least at first. But those promises from Sackett didn't really pan out in the end, did they?
No, they didn't. Even with all the extra time, Sackett just couldn't make those payments. And so eventually, Spindler had to cut his losses and terminate the contract on October 5th, 1961. And here's another important point to keep in mind. During all of this back and forth, the value of S&S Newspapers was actually going down. So basically the business itself was losing value as this whole drama was unfolding.
Oh, so that really puts Spindler in a bind, right? He's stuck with a business that's worth less and a buyer who can't pay up. So what did he do next?
Well, he did eventually manage to sell the shares to someone else, but it took a while. It wasn't until July of 1962, almost the year after the original agreement, that he was able to sell the shares. And even then, he only got $20,680 for them. Quite a drop from that $85,000 price tag.
Wow, a big loss. So I guess that sets the stage for the legal battle that followed. And what's interesting here is that it was actually Sackett who first filed a lawsuit against Spindler, right? That seems a little surprising considering, you know, he was one who didn't pay up.
Yeah, it does seem a little counterintuitive. So Sackett sues Spindler for money had and received.
Hmm.
Basically, he's trying to get back the payments that he had made,
yeah.
You know, arguing that the deal had fallen apart. And as you might expect, Spindler fires back with a counterclaim suing Sackett for breach of contract.
Okay, so a classic legal showdown. So who came out on top in the trial court?
The trial court sided with Spindler. They decided that Sackett's repeated failure to make those payments, especially that bounce check, was a material and total breach of their contract. And so they awarded Spindler damages to the tune of $34,575.74.
Okay, so let's dig into that damages number a bit. How did they actually come up with that specific amount?
It's a fairly straightforward calculation, actually. They took the original contract price, which was $85,000, and then they subtracted everything that Sackett had actually paid, which came out to $29,744.26. And then they subtracted the amount that Spindler got when he eventually resold the shares, which was $20,680. And that leaves you with the $34,575.74 that they awarded to Spindler.
Okay, so it seems like a pretty logical way to figure out the direct financial loss that Spindler suffered. But I remember in the guidance materials, there was something about an issue with interest in this case as well.
Yeah, that's an interesting wrinkle in this whole thing. Initially, the trial court did include interest as part of the damages, but then they changed their minds and decided not to include it. Their reasoning was that the damages weren't considered certain enough.
Interesting. And I'm guessing that decision to not award interest is what led Sackett to appeal the case to the California Court of Appeal, right?
You got it. Sackett wasn't happy with the trial court's ruling, and he felt that it was legally incorrect. So that brings us to the big legal questions that the appellate court had to wrestle with.
Okay, so when the case went up on appeal, what were the main issues that the court had to decide?
Well, they had three main things to consider. First was Sackett's failure to pay a serious enough breach of the contract, what we call a material breach, to give Spindler the right to end the whole deal. Second, did the trial court calculate the damages correctly? And third, did Spindler do everything he could to minimize his losses after Sackett broke the contract? This is known as the duty to mitigate damages.
You know, these are really the fundamental building blocks of contract law, so let's take these one at a time. Starting with material breach. What exactly does that mean in a legal sense?
Okay, so basically a material breach is when one party screws up so badly in fulfilling their side of the contract that it lets the other party, the non-breaching party, in this case Spindler, just say, okay, I'm done with this deal. It's got to be more than just a minor slip-up. It has to really strike at the heart of the agreement.
So it's not just any little mistake. It has to be a pretty big deal. So how do courts figure out if a breach is serious enough to be a material breach? Is there some kind of checklist they use?
There's not like a rigid set of rules, but courts do usually look at a few key factors. And our podcast guidance actually lists six of these questions. The first one is, did Spindler get the main benefit he was expecting from the contract? And in this case, the answer is pretty clearly no. He never got all the money he was supposed to get for his shares.
Right. If you don't get the core thing you bargained for, that's a major problem. What's the second factor they look at?
The second factor is, could money damages make up for what Sackett failed to do? So in this case, even though Spindler got some money in damages, the fact that Sackett didn't make those payments in the first place suggests that just getting those partial payments wasn't enough to put Spindler in the position he would have been in if Sackett had actually paid everything he was supposed to.
Okay, that makes sense. So what about the third factor?
The third factor is how much Sackett had actually done to fulfill his side of the contract. So yes, he did make some initial payments, but when you compare that to the full purchase price and the fact that he ultimately failed to pay most of it, the court probably saw that as pretty minor in the grand scheme of things. You can't just put down a small deposit and then bail on your obligations without any repercussions.
That's a good point. What's the next factor on the list?
The fourth factor is the hardship on Sackett if the contract gets terminated. So the court would think about whether ending the deal would be unfair to Sackett. But in this case, since Sackett's own actions, you know, his failure to pay up caused this potential hardship, it probably didn't really help his case. You know, if you're the one who created the mess, it's hard to argue that it's unfair when the other party tries to protect themselves.
Makes sense. What's the fifth thing they look at?
The fifth factor is Sackett's behavior and intentions. You know, was he acting in good faith? Well, that bounce check and those kind of vague promises to pay later definitely don't paint a picture of someone who was trying their best to do what they agreed to. It looked like he was being at least negligent. And it made Spindler really uncertain about whether he'd ever see the rest of the money.
Right. All that uncertainty probably ties into the sixth factor, doesn't it?
Exactly. The last factor is how likely was it that Sackett would actually follow through on the rest of the contract? Given his track record of missed deadlines and that bounce check, the court could reasonably conclude that the chances of him coming up with that huge remaining payment were pretty slim. So taking all these things together, the appellate court agreed with the trial court that Sackett's breach was material. And in fact, they called it a total breach, which meant Spindler had every right to terminate the contract. So it's not just about whether a promise was broken, it's about how badly that broken promise messed up the whole deal and the expectations of the other party.
Okay, so we've established that the breach was material, but you mentioned earlier that Spindler reclaimed those stock certificates. Could someone argue that that was Spindler agreeing to cancel the contract or rescission rather than ending it because of Sackett's breach?
That's a really important point. Terminating a contract and rescinding a contract are two different things. Termination means the contract ends because someone broke the rules in a major way. But the non-breaching party, in this case Spindler, can still go after the other party for damages. Rescission, on the other hand, is basically like hitting the undo button on the contract as if it never existed. Usually it happens when both parties agree to call the whole thing off. The court made it clear that what Spindler did was terminate the contract because of Sackett's material breach. He didn't agree to just forget about the whole thing and let Sackett off the hook. He ended it because Sackett didn't hold up his end of the bargain, and that's why he could sue for the money he lost.
Okay, so the breach was serious enough, and Spindler was in the right to end the contract. Now let's talk about those damages. We went over how the trial court calculated them, but did the appellate court agree with their method?
Yep, they did.
Yep.
The formula was basically the original price minus what Sackett had already paid and minus what Spindler got when he finally sold the shares.
Yeah.
But the key here is what they were buying and selling.
Hmm.
All the shares of a newspaper company. The court recognized that this wasn't like selling something ordinary where it's easy to find out the market price.
Right. It's not like selling, you know, a dozen eggs or something. Each business is unique, especially something like a newspaper. It's not like there's a stock market for every small business out there.
Exactly. And because there wasn't an established, easy-to-find market price for all the shares of SNS newspapers, the court thought that the price Spindler eventually got when he resold them was a reasonable way to measure his losses because of Sackett's breach. This actually lines up with a legal principle that's mentioned in the briefs, that when there's no established market for something, the damages can be the difference between the original price and what you get when you resell it.
Okay, so that makes sense. But what about Spindler's efforts to actually sell the newspaper? Did the court look into whether he tried hard enough to get a good price?
That brings us to the duty to mitigate damages, which is a super important idea in contract law. Basically, it means that if someone breaks a contract and you suffer losses, you have a responsibility to do what you can to minimize those losses. You can't just sit back and let the damages pile up.
So you have to be proactive and try to limit the damage. So in this case, what did Spindler do to try and cut his losses after Sackett failed to pay?
Well, the court looked at the facts of the case, and they saw that Spindler did take several steps. Like we talked about before, he gave Sackett several extensions to try and make those payments. And when it became clear that IndyWiz wasn't going to work, he took steps to resell the shares. Interestingly, the podcast guidance also mentions that Spindler changed the newspaper to a weekly publication to try and reduce operating costs while he was looking for a buyer. The court looked at all of this and decided that Spindler had acted reasonably under the circumstances to mitigate his damages. So the lesson here is even when someone else messes up, you can't just let the losses spiral out of control. You have to take reasonable steps to limit the damage.
So Spindler didn't just try to dump the entire cost on Sackett without lifting a finger himself. He really did try to lessen the blow.
Exactly. And that's a big takeaway from this case. If you're ever in a contract dispute, you've got to be able to show that you took reasonable steps to reduce the harm you suffered. Okay, so let's come back to that issue of interest on the damages. The trial court went back and forth on that. Why did the appellate court ultimately agree to leave interest out of the damages?
Well, this part of the case comes down to a very specific rule in California about when you can award interest on damages. In California, you can only get interest on damages if the amount of those damages is certain, meaning it's a fixed amount that's easy to calculate. The appellate court said that in this case, the amount of Spindler's damages wasn't certain enough at the exact moment that Sackett breached the contract.
Okay, so why weren't the damages certain at that time?
There were a couple of reasons. First, the exact date when Sackett breached the contract wasn't totally clear. Second, and probably more importantly, they didn't know how much Spindler would get when he resold the shares until he actually sold them in July of 1962. Since they didn't know those two key things, the exact date of the breach and the final sale price at the time of the breach, the appellate court agreed that the damages weren't certain enough to justify adding interest.
So even though the formula for calculating the damages was pretty simple, the fact that they didn't know the exact date of the breach and the final sale price meant that those damages weren't considered certain under the law, and so they couldn't add interest. It really shows you that even when you're just dealing with money, the little details and the timing can be really important in legal cases.
Absolutely. And this case, even though it's from the 1960s, it's a great example of how the basic principles of contract law that law students are learning today actually work in real life. It shows you how courts analyze whether a breach of contract is bad enough to end the deal, the ways they calculate damages when you're dealing with something unique, and the importance of mitigating your losses.
It really drives home the point that you need to have clear and well-defined terms in your contracts, and that there can be serious consequences if you don't live up to those obligations. And it shows you how carefully courts look at these situations, taking into account all these different factors to reach a fair outcome.
It's a good reminder that contract law isn't just some abstract theoretical stuff. It's about real agreements between people and businesses and what happens when those agreements fall apart.
So to quickly summarize what we've learned from Sackett v. Spindler today, we talk about what makes a breach of contract material and the six main things that courts look at to figure that out. We saw how damages can be calculated for unique things where there's no clear market price, and we talked about the duty to mitigate damages, which means taking steps to minimize your losses. And finally, we touched on how the requirement for certainty in damages plays out when it comes to awarding interest.
All really important stuff for anyone studying contract law.
Now, here's something to think about as you're thinking about this case. What if there had been a well-established market for S&S newspaper shares back then? How do you think the outcome of the case might have been different? Would they have calculated the damages differently? Would Spindler have had different obligations to mitigate his losses? I think that's a really interesting question to ponder because it gets at the heart of these legal principles we've been talking about.
Yeah, that's a great point. And as we've seen in this deep dive, Sackett v. Spindler gives you a really solid foundation for understanding these key contract law concepts. But there's always more to learn, so keep digging into this case and explore other related cases as you continue your legal studies.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. We'll see you next time.